Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, October 14th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Eureka Police Department receives $40,000 grant from Alcoholic Beverage Control to help fight alcohol-related harm. Cal Poly Humboldt students and faculty come out to support Palestine by holding a vigil and march around campus on 2-year anniversary of October 7th. Friends of the Eel River call for removal of Eel River dams, currently in 401 water quality certification process for removal. And over 50 prescribed burns planned around Laytonville this winter. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
On October 9th, the Eureka Police Department, EPD, received a $40,000 grant from Alcoholic Beverage Control, ABC, to help fight alcohol-related harm. The grant was awarded through ABC's Alcohol Policing Partnership, APP, program, a grant program in California that funds local law enforcement agencies specifically so that they can reduce alcohol-related harm in their communities. According to ABC's website, the mission of the program is to, quote, work with law enforcement agencies to develop an effective, comprehensive, and strategic approach to eliminating the crime and public nuisance problems associated with problematic alcoholic beverage outlets and then institutionalize those approaches within the local police agency, end quote. KMUD News spoke with Laura Montagna, EPD's public information officer, for more information on the grant that the department received.
The Eureka Police Department receives a $40,000 grant to fight alcohol-related harm. This was given from the California Department of Alcohol Beverage Control to reduce alcohol-related harm in the community. This grant will assist the City of Eureka in protecting youth and addressing crime at problem locations. The grant is one of nearly 50 awarded in California to local law enforcement agencies through ABC's Alcohol Policing Partnership Program. These grants strengthen local law enforcement efforts by pairing them with ABC agents who have expertise in alcohol beverage laws to help reduce alcohol-related harm within communities. The Alcohol Policing Partnership Program can improve the quality of life in neighborhoods and make a real difference in the communities where program resources are invested. The APP program was created in 1995 to strengthen partnerships between ABC and local law enforcement agencies. The program is designed to keep alcohol away from minors and prevent harm to the community. The funds will be used to help prevent alcohol beverage sales to minors and obviously intoxicated patrons, illegal solicitation of alcohol, and other criminal activities such as the sale and possession of illegal drugs. The mission of the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control is to provide the highest level of service and public safety to the people of the state through licensing, education, and enforcement.
Grant agencies, or departments that are awarded the grant, will have experienced ABC agents assigned to train officers in ABC law, alcohol enforcement strategies and tactics, administrative license revocation procedures, and community resources. For more information on the APP program, the website is abc.ca.gov/enforcement/alcohol-policing-partnership. On the 2-year anniversary of October 7th, Cal Poly Humboldt students held a vigil and march to remember and support Palestine. Gabriel Zucker reports.
Free, free Palestine!
On October 7th, 2025, Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, and Students for Quality Education, or SQE, organized a vigil and march at Cal Poly Humboldt in response to the ongoing conflict between Palestine and Israel. After meeting in the Arquad at Cal Poly Humboldt at 10 a.m., they held a vigil and gave speeches on why this was important. Afterwards, they marched across campus holding signs and chanting to end the inhumanity in Gaza. Fletcher Edwards, the vice president for the Students for a Democratic Society at Humboldt campus, was there to spread awareness on Palestine's worsening situation and show the importance of standing up for what is right.
I'm here because it is October 7th and we need to show folks that there is still very much an issue happening with Palestine. After the Palestine protests that happened on campus with the encampments a while back, there really hasn't been too much by way of action, despite the fact that the genocide and surrounding situations have only continued to get worse. So this action is a way of showing that yes, we are still here, people do still care about this, and we do still stand in solidarity with Palestine. That's the general reason that I'm here for this.
This protest brought a lot of different people together in joint support of the Palestinian people. Madan Tavernisi, a transfer student and activist with SDS, gave a speech about her relationship with the conflict as someone converting to Judaism and emphasized the need for people to stand up.
I gave a speech today because I think it is important as a white settler and as someone on a journey of conversion to Judaism that has been continuous and has been quite fraught over the last few years, that I be the one to stand up and speak as students across the nation face increasing suppression and higher risks to their safety and their livelihoods simply for expressing their political opinion on campuses, something that college students have been doing for the entire history of American universities.
Leading up to the vigil, there was a lot of confusion on where it would be held. This was due to a conflicting event being held in the Upper Quad that week, celebrating the Jewish holiday Sukkot. Due to the relationship between Israel and Palestine, some felt there was a connection between the two events and felt the school was showing favoritism by moving the Palestinian vigil to the Art Quad last second. Rick Toledo, an environmental engineering grad student at Cal Poly Humboldt and one of the organizers for Students for a Democratic Society, felt this was unacceptable because after going through the right channels, they were still facing an uphill climb to hold this event.
We were trying to set this up a week in advance from today. We went to reserve the space. We tried to use the actual official channels to do it at the start. The lower quad was uncontested. There were no other events in that area, and it's a distinctly reservable space from the upper quad in 25 Live, which is a system the university uses. So we didn't see any problem with it, right? Because there was no conflict. We ran into immediate trouble where they said that our organization was not completely activated as an RSO because one of our members was just finishing their last training, but they finished it that day, so it really wasn't that big of a thing. But in that time frame, we had been planning the event with Students for Quality Education, and they have the California Faculty Association reserve spaces for them. So they went on the thing and said, okay, you know, we're going to reserve the space because it's a SQE event as well as an SCS event. And then we got hit with, well, there's a conflict. At first, they would not tell us exactly what the conflict was. It was just, oh, there's another organization that's doing something there. But when I looked, there was no conflict. So I'm like, well, which one? Because there's nothing here. It's a blank slate. And they said, well, I think it's Chabad at Humboldt, which is the Zionist organization on campus, was having their Sukkot event where they build the Sukkah in the upper quad for the week. And we said, well, that's not a conflict. We're in a totally different reservable space than you. And we don't have a problem with our event. You know, it sounds like they might have a problem with us or you might have a problem with us, but we're okay with this event being here. We have no problem with that. We have a Jewish speaker coming from JVP National. We have Jewish students helping organize this. Our faculty advisor is Jewish for our RSO. It's a non-issue for us. But they doubled and tripled down on it. They would not allow us to use that space. And ultimately what happened was they threatened the union, and the union was like, we're going to have to move to the Art Quad. And we said, we don't want to do that. So there was definitely some tension there. But we eventually decided to move the vigil to the Art Quad. It would have been too difficult to have a space to remember Palestinians and to honor them when we have them trying to shut us down the whole time. And, you know, we're still having our march and we'll still be in the main quad for that and going around. So I think that's where we'll be able to make a little more noise. And really our hope for today is to let people know that we've been discriminated against and also to bring attention back to Palestine and the struggling of Palestinians.
According to Ryder Deshida, the history education program leader and the individual who set up the event, gave a little more backstory to the confusion and how it was not about the school picking a side, but instead was because the vigil was unable to make a reservation for the top quad in time.
Students for Quality Education and Students for Democratic Society were coordinating to hold a vigil and march here on the university main quad where we are currently located at. Students for Democratic Society did not have an officer who could make the reservation through the university's space reservation system. So Students for Quality Education volunteered themselves through California Faculty Association, of which I'm chapter president, to make that reservation. I agreed to that. When SDS made that request, they were informed by the university's reservations coordinator that 2 weeks ago, another organization, Stand With Us, had made a request to reserve the space. SDS made this request last Tuesday. So in essence, they were beaten to the punch to have this space reserved. One of the leaders of SDS, Richard Toledo, seemed to take this as a discriminatory action, that the university was discriminating against a pro-Palestinian march and was aligning itself with a Zionist Zionist organization. I caught wind of this on Sunday late morning, early afternoon, and as the individual responsible for making the space reservation, I felt I had to step in. Now, the university did very accommodatingly, diplomatically, offered the Art Quad as an alternative, to which I agreed. So that's what happened. And this was literally agreed to on Sunday afternoon, I want to say around 4:30 p.m. We got the march route in, and it was altered and agreed upon by both the University Conference and Event Services and CFA yesterday at around 11 a.m. That's how that whole thing happened in terms of they wanted the University Quad. They were offered the Art Quad. They took that to mean that they were being discriminated against by the university when in actuality they had been beaten to the punch by another organization. So I suppose the lesson from that for SDS and SQE is to be better organized in order to achieve what they want.
This was confirmed by Joanne Yamani, the Executive Director of Strategic Communications at Cal Poly Humboldt.
The Vigil space reservation was submitted outside of our standard 2-week advance notice window. Reservation requests are reviewed and granted on a first-come, first-served basis for space reservations. Additionally, other events were already approved for the Quad on October 7th through timely requests. So we offered the Art Quad as an alternative venue and worked with organizers to determine a march route. The advanced planning and partnership with the event organizers led to successful events aligned with the university's long-held practices of peaceful expression. Peaceful demonstrations are a part of the university's culture, reflecting its values of open and respectful dialogue. Cal Poly Humboldt wholeheartedly supports the constitutional rights of free expression and assembly. We encourage open and respectful discussions, inviting everyone to share their perspectives in ways that contribute positively to the university's shared learning environment.
Despite the confusion and restrictions, the students still came out to stand together in solidarity with the Palestinian people. The protest was peaceful and ran smoothly with no confrontations. Even though the vigil had to be moved from the upper quad to the R quad, the intent of the protest still shone through. MJ Gutierrez, a member of the Students for Equality Education, shared their thoughts on the conflict between the event and the school, emphasizing the need to come and show out no matter the location or roadblock in the way.
It was a struggle getting this event together. There was a little hesitance due to an overlap on there's a tabling happening later today on campus, and because there was an overlap, we weren't able to have the event, but we just kept fighting, wanted to have it in any way. There was a move needed and we were gonna have it regardless. So we kind of did the move to the Art Quad and we were still able to have the event if we moved it. So we decided that we didn't want to have our message completely shut out. We wanted to still give Palestine the vigil and the Palestinian lives lost. It was important that the message carried on, so we decided to move anyway. We were going to go to the quad anyway regardless, but we realized that it was just going to lead to perhaps a bigger escalation and our message would have been lost and muddied up. So we decided to just peacefully move over here, and whoever didn't get the info that we got the location changed, then we were going to just go pick them up.
Reporting from KMUD, this is Gabriel Zucker.
Starting today, the California State Water Resources Control Board will be hosting a series of in-person and online scoping meetings about the surrender and decommissioning of PG&E's Potter Valley Project dam removal on the Eel River. There will be 3 in-person meetings starting today at the River Lodge Conference Center in Fortuna, starting at 6 p.m., on Wednesday at the Ukiah Valley Conference Center at 11:30 a.m., and on the same day at the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board office in Santa Rosa at 5:30 p.m. On Friday the 17th, there will be a hybrid meeting, both in person and online in Sacramento, which can be accessed via Zoom. Friends of the Eel River have been highlighting the environmental impacts that the Potter Valley Dam Project has had for years and encourage the public to attend these meetings and submit public comment, either in person or written, to further the dam removal process. KMA News spoke with Alicia Hammond, Executive Director for Friends of the Eel River, for more information on how the Potter Valley Dam Project has been affecting communities and the environment.
So there are 2 dams in the headwaters of the Eel River. They're called Scott and Cape Horn Dams, and they also include a diversion from the Eel River into the Russian River. And collectively, this entire project is called the Potter Valley Project. PG&E has owned the project since 1930, but it is a little bit older than that. The first dam was actually built in 1908. So for about 120 years now, we have been diverting water from the Eel into the Russian, which in the past was a really significant quantity of water, which was very problematic. These days, it's a much smaller amount of water, but it still happens at a seasonally inappropriate time, which causes a good deal of harm to the Eel River. The project also does not include fish passage past the upper dam, and so it blocks access to about 280 miles of really excellent habitat, especially for the Eel River's steelhead, which are very special fish for this region. The dams also cause accumulation of methylated mercury. They disrupt the flow of sediment, and they artificially warm the water in the upper basin, resulting in warmer water released downstream of the dams than would naturally occur.
Earlier this summer, in July, PG&E, who have owned the project since 1930, submitted a surrender application and decommissioning plan for the project to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. With this application filed, PG&E have been developing management plans that will eventually further detail the process of decommissioning the dam and aspects of the project. Here's Hammond with more information on how the decommission process is going.
So right now, where we are at in the process to remove the dams is that earlier this summer, PG&E submitted their license surrender application and decommissioning plan to FERC. That's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and that's the entity that oversees hydropower projects. And as part of the whole package of permitting dam removal, the state also has a role to play. And one of the things that the state of California does is issue clean water certification. And so that's done by the State Water Board, and they've just begun the scoping process for their clean water certification.
The meetings that will be taking place this week with the California State Water Resources Control Board are mandated for this kind of decommissioning in Section 401 of the Clean Water Act and are meant to provide information and transparency to the public about this project and the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, process. The Section 401 process is a direct way for community members to ensure PG&E and entities like it in these scenarios improve water quality, restore the habitat, and protect downriver communities and tribal resources. Hammond speaks more on the meetings and what they intend to do.
There's a few simple but very important things that we want to convey at this phase in the process. First of all, we want the water board certification to happen quickly and not risk delaying dam removal. 401 certifications are now limited to a one-year timeline, but it's still worth it to emphasize to the water board that this project causes ongoing water quality impacts. And that we want to get the project removed as quickly as possible to mitigate those impacts. So I want to emphasize to the water board that the long-term effects of dam removal will be a net positive for water quality. And the State Water Board actually has a restoration policy which allows staff to certify projects that have short-term impacts where there will be long-term benefits. And the project definitely applies to that. So we want to encourage the water board to frame this as a restoration project, which it really is. Of course, while there are long-term effects are a net positive, there will definitely be short-term impacts that are going to harm aquatic life. And it'll be kind of similar to what we saw on the Klamath, where when the dams are ultimately removed and that, big plug of sediment moves through the watershed, we're going to see dissolved oxygen drops very low and a lot of turbidity in the river. And so we need to make sure that the water board funds monitoring before and after this process and also, does some studies to really thoroughly model how the sediment is going to move and how it's going to be transported downstream under a variety of conditions. The sediment release will also need to be timed appropriately to limit those impacts to aquatic life. And then we'll need an assessment of how revegetating with native plants can help control erosion in the reservoir footprint. So these are some of the things that we would encourage folks to say to the water board in their oral or written comments. And again, you can find all of this written down at eelriver.org.
Once again, the meetings with the California State Water Resources Control Board are today in Fortuna at the River Lodge Conference Center from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Wednesday, October 15th from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Ukiah Valley Conference Center, and on the same day from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. in Santa Rosa at the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board office. There will also be one on Friday, October 17th from 12:30 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. available online on Zoom. For more information on these meetings and Zoom links, the website is eelriver.org. The Eel River Recovery Project is partnering with CAL FIRE and others to bring a series of prescribed burns to the 10-mile creek drainage north of Laytonville in order to make the ecosystem more resilient in the face of wildfires. K-Mud Sigur Bjorn spoke to burn boss Scott Steinbring, who is overseeing the winter-long operation.
Today saw a prescribed burn applied in the 10-mile creek drainage northwest of Laytonville, Mendocino County. It's the first of roughly 50 burns that would be applied over the course of the winter in the watershed in order to make the forest healthier and mitigate possible damage were wildfire to erupt in these lands in the future. We spoke to Scott Steinbring, burn boss at Torchbearer, a prescribed burn unit based out of Soames Bar in Siskiyou County, who oversees the project. Torchbearer has operated all over the state and country, but as Steinberg explains, the 10-mile creek watershed will be their base this winter.
Our focus will be Mendocino County this year, and we've been working with Eel River Recovery and doing a lot of fuels work in the 10-mile creek drainage. And so for the last year, fuels crews have been cutting, piling, stacking, thinning the forest. So we are now going to be doing broadcast burning on the 10-mile creek drainage, starting from Rattlesnake all the way down into the community of Laytonville, California.
As Steinbring explains, he is no stranger to this part of Mendocino, having already spent last winter on the first entry of the prescribed burn.
This is the second entry of a prescription. The first one was that, you know, the contractors went in and built the piles, cut and piled them, and then we burned them last year, and now it's ready to receive its first broadcast understory burn. I think we burned 170 acres last year and had over, I think, 160 participants attending those burns.
Broadcast burns and pile burns are two separate elements of a prescribed burn, which has several different components to it.
So prescribed fire is an implementation tool to reduce vegetation that's been thinned, removing some of that duff layer or brush. It's a very tight prescription with lots of variables of weather and resources. And basically, the burning a pile or hundreds of acres of piles is also prescribed burning, just in a different concept versus broadcast burning, where we're lighting not only the slash, but we are burning all of the understory in low intensity fire.
A huge part of getting a prescribed burn right is controlling the intensity of the fire, down to calculating the approximate height of the flames of the burn, so that they manage to burn the understory without harming the canopy above.
Most prescribed burning is happening during the fall and spring because that's when our fuel moistures are the highest. And so, you know, we're looking at those fuel moistures and the weather that's coming. And depending on how much fuel loading is on the ground in underneath the timber, you may want a cooler burn because of the fact that you're going to send too much heat into the canopy. And so we're dictating our flame lengths by how much moisture we're going to allow before we start burning. We talk about prescribed fire being one of those elements of hardening the timber. So as the fire crosses the landscape, the bark will char, and that charring will harden and maybe take away some of the moss, and it will take away some of the pitch. And so that when a fire does come through there at a lower intensity, those things have already been taken care of or burned and won't ignite again. And that would be something that we look at in the suppression efforts, to where we can do the most value of stopping a fire.
Residents in the Laytonville area and motorists driving up and down Highway 101 in northern Mendocino can expect intermittent, short-duration smoke throughout the winter from the burns, which can impact air quality and impair visibility, starting today.
All of our air quality permits and burn permits have been approved. our resources are accounted for, if weather and air quality is acceptable. We work from the top down, so we will start up at Rattlesnake Summit and work our way down. We have 300 acres, 269 roughly there, and so that'll keep us busy for a little bit, and then we'll go to the west side of the 10 Mile Creek and take care of some smaller units. And every week thereafter, we will be looking at another burn opportunity within the 10 Mile Creek drainage.
That was Scott Steinbring with Prescription Burn Unit Torchbearer, which is overseeing several burns in northern Mendocino this winter. I'm Sigurd Buren, reporting for KMUD.
And in National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As of Monday, one person has died, two are still missing, and 51 have been rescued following a record-breaking storm that slammed into the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta in southwest Alaska over the weekend. Officials say search and rescue efforts are ongoing. Coast Guard Commander for Western Alaska, Christopher Culpepper, compares the devastation to the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina.
Several of these villages have been completely devastated, absolutely flooded, several feet deep. And so this took homes off of foundations. This took people into peril, where folks were swimming, floating, trying to find debris to hold on to in the cover of darkness at nighttime.
He spoke at a news conference Monday with other officials the day after the remnants of Typhoon Halong barreled into remote coastal communities in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, hitting the villages of Kipnuk and Quigilingok especially hard. The storm brought winds of over 100 miles per hour and record flood waters. Helicopters, planes, drones, ships, and pararescuers from the Coast Guard, National Guard, and other agencies worked through the night and are still searching for two missing people. Officials said Monday that one woman, previously unaccounted for, was found dead. More than 1,000 people are in community shelters. Alaska National Guard head Torrance Sachs says he has activated every member of the state's National Guard and Alaska State Defense Force living in Western Alaska, and more are set to join.
This may end up being the largest off-the-road system response for the National Guard in about 45 years.
State officials say dozens of nonprofit organizations, businesses, and faith-based groups are also coordinating recovery efforts. Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy has declared a disaster for the region, easing access to additional resources.
We know you need help. We're going to continue to get the help to you. We're going to do everything we can to get everything up and running as quickly as possible. And we will continue to help, not just today, tomorrow, but weeks and months on, and until we get things back to what used to be at least considered semi-normal.
The governor and members of Alaska's congressional delegation say they plan to visit the region. The storm's devastation is on the minds of many people who traveled to Anchorage this week from across the state to gather for two conferences being held in the city, the First Alaskans Institute's Elders and Youth Conference and the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. The AFN is the state's largest gathering, which gets underway Thursday. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, AFN is a time to address challenges that face Alaska Native people and stand together.
Next year, AFN turns 60 years old. It was formed to fight for land claims, culminating in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. ANCSA created Native corporations to manage land and wealth. It was far from perfect, but each year, AFN works to improve upon the outcomes.
At AFN, the one unifying factor for us is protecting our way of life.
A way of life that AFN's co-chair, Joe Nelson, says has been threatened by federal cutbacks and new policies that affect Native lands. AFN delegates had hoped to talk directly with Trump administration cabinet members, who, along with Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, were scheduled to speak at the gathering, but the federal shutdown has prevented them from traveling to Alaska. Their speeches will now be virtual. Not the same as FaceTime, but Nelson says the work will go on regardless.
But we're going to gather as we do as Native folks, start beating our drums, just working together united.
This year, AFN delegates have almost 100 resolutions to consider. Many of them address protecting the hunting and gathering of wild foods or subsistence. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Gabriel Zucker, Sigurd Bjorn, and Antonia Gonzalez. KEMA News is online, and you can find us on KEMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kemud.org. Are you passionate about your community? Looking to report on what's happening around Mendocino? KEMA News is looking for stringer reporters from the Mendocino area to cover local Mendocino stories that matter. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just eager to learn, we'll help you get started. You'll get training, support, and a chance to amplify real voices from your community. If you're interested, email news@kema.org for more information. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.